Okay, we're going to open up the phone lines, give you a chance to chat with Ted Koppel. Lights Out, his book about a cyber attack on our power grid systems. And that's all we need with everything else going on this planet. We're going to come back with Ted and you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We'll get to your calls in just a second with Ted Koppel. We're talking about his work, Lights Out. Ted, you were able to take us through the Iranian hostage situation, 9/11, two Iraq wars, and so many other tragic stories. What is your take on just the direction of this planet today? I mean, to me, gosh, it sounds like it's just topsy-turvy.
Well, I'll tell you what, George, let's talk about what just happened in Paris.
Okay.
You know, I wish that we would begin by asking ourselves what I think is the most fundamental question. What is it that ISIS wants us to do? And once we determine what we think that is, let's not do it. And I'm afraid that we are moving in exactly the wrong direction. I think we're about to give ISIS, or are in the process of giving ISIS, exactly what it wants. It's being treated as though it were a superpower like the former Soviet Union. It's being treated as though it were the greatest danger to the United States that has ever existed. The fact of the matter is it may become an enormous danger, and it may become an enormous danger precisely in the context of what you and I have spent the past hour talking about. But let's not give these people more status than they deserve. And let's not become engaged in the kind of war that is going to separate Muslims from Jews and Christians around the world. That's what they want to achieve. They're looking for that kind of a global struggle. And I hope we don't give it to them.
When I saw the video on the various newscasts of the miles and miles long of ISIS members in their Humvees and trucks waving their flags in Iraq, I looked at that, Ted, and I 9 years I spent in the Navy, and I looked at that and I said, there is not one Apache helicopter, not one fighter jet taking out these columns of trucks and people who are just sitting ducks, waving and waving. I can't understand it. I got to think there's something else going on here.
Well, I wish I knew what it was, George, but I don't.
I know. I know that. The presidential candidates, what's your take on all of this?
I'm gonna resort back to good old Winston Churchill, who once said, you know, the Americans always end up doing the right thing, but only after they've exhausted every other possibility.
Yeah.
I think we're in the process of exhausting every other possibility. I'm sure there are lots of folks out there who support any number of the candidates, most particular Mr. Trump and Dr. Carson right now and Carly Fiorina. I just cannot believe that ultimately we're going to end up making a decision, the essence of which is, let's put someone in the White House who has absolutely no experience whatsoever.
I agree with that. It's going to be an interesting take on all of this. When you started in television, as I did, we had three major networks. That was it. That was the competition. And look at television now. We have so many channels. You can't keep up with what's out there anymore. Yeah, I'm amazed by it.
It's really fragmented everything. And, it is, there is a danger to having too much partisanship out there. There really is a danger to, you know, having to view everything through the lens of either being a conservative or a liberal on the issue. And I realize that this is, this is the kind of drum that's been beaten to death over the last few years. But the fact of the matter is we are in too much of a rush to point the finger at one another and question one another's motives in terms of what each of us believes. What you and I remember, which perhaps fortunately will never be repeated, is a time when there were only three networks and folks gathered in front of that flickering altar at 6:30 or 7 o'clock every evening, and they watched the Cronkites and the Huntley Brinkleys, and mm-hmm. there was a tendency, A, to accept that these people really did have our best interests in at heart, and that what they were offering us was the most important news that they felt we needed to know. And I think the commercialization and the fragmentation of television today has forced so many of the television outlets to the point where they're just giving the public what they think the public wants to hear, wants to see. And too often that's the latest round in the epic of the Kardashian family or whatever the latest weather news is. There are really important things going on in the world today. And we need to have some confidence in the people who are delivering this news to us.
I bet if you went out and talked to younger people in their 20s and asked them, who's Walter Cronkite, who's Ted Koppel,
sure.
who's John Chancellor, they wouldn't know.
No, and I used to do that when young interns came to work at Nightline, and there would also be, you know, they'd always be a little bit nervous about approaching me in the beginning, and I'd say to them, listen, let's just play a game here. How many of you remember the name Walter Cronkite? And essentially every hand would go up, and then I'd start going down the fame list until we got to the Eric Severides and the Howard K. Smiths. And, you know, by the time I got to Eric Severide, no hands would go up. And I'd say to them, that's what you need to understand about the fame and the importance of network news anchors. The fame has a half-life of about a decade. After 10 years, nobody remembers anyway.
When you joined Nightline, brainchild, I believe, of Rune Arledge at the time,
Well, actually, what was the brainchild of Rune Arledge was covering the Iran hostage crisis.
Mm-hmm.
As you may recall, it was called America Held Hostage. And for the first, well, from November, I think the program began about November 8th of 1979. And from November 8th, 1979, until March 24th of 1980, it was America held hostage day 5, day 7, day 28, day 110.
That's right, yeah.
And then Nightline was born out of that because the program at that point was a special report, which meant, and this will mean something to you and maybe not so much to members of your audience, it was sustaining. They couldn't charge any money for commercials because it was a special event. So in order to start making money, they had lost a couple of $1 million by March of 1980. In order to start making money, they had to turn it into a regularly scheduled program. And that's how Nightline was born.
And Arledge started off in charge of sports for ABC, of course.
He was. He was the president of sports. And for a while, he jointly ruled the sports division and the news division. But eventually, he just took over news.
Super. Let's take some calls here for you, Ted. Lights Out. It's a great read. It's an important read about the possibility of a cyber attack on our power grid systems. Let's pick it up by, first of all, going to Joe in Syracuse, New York, east of the Rockies. Joe, you're on with Ted Koppel on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
George, Ted, how you guys doing tonight?
Doing fine.
One question. I started out in networking in my late teens. What are the odds that the three major power grids in our nation can transform their existing system to a secure, closed network with no external internet access to monitor and control our power grid?
I think in order for that to happen, you'd have to re-regulate the industry, and the industry is going to fight that tooth and nail. I think where we are moving and where we are making some progress is with what are called these microgrids. And there tend to be microgrids, for the most part, in some rural areas. Very, very difficult to envision a day when microgrids will be feeding cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles.
Some states are trying to insulate their own grid systems against an EMP or against a solar flare, but the cyber attack, as you pointed out, that's something else. That's difficult to stop.
It's not just difficult. It's it's impossible to stop. You know, if we have the capacity to take out a Russian grid or a Chinese grid or any grid around the world, offensively, the United States has the greatest cyber capabilities of any country in the world. But defense is another matter altogether.
Scary times. We really are in scary times. Dan in Montrose, New York. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure.
Glad to talk to you, Ted. Listen, in the 90s, Art Bell, with his people, sounded the alarm everybody felt about the warning of Y2K.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody was scared about that. And, of course, when 2000 approached after 1999, it was nowhere as bad. A few glitches, but nothing like that. Could it be possible that this time, with the help of Ted Koppel and others, that maybe in this case as well, we're all sounding the alarm, that you people are sounding the alarm about the cyber attack? And I just want to know how you feel about that. If this will help out like it did Y2K, I know this is a lot worse, but what is your feelings on that? And I'll take
it. I was at an event the other day with General Keith Alexander. He is now retired. He's the former head of the NSA. Talking about industries and companies out there, he said there are only two kinds of companies out there, those that have been hacked and those that don't yet know it. I think it would be naive in the extreme to assume that the only industry that is not being hacked, and in fact we know as a matter of course, there are daily cyber attacks being launched against the power industry.
Yes.
It's only a question of if and when one of those attacks is implemented. No, I don't think this is the equivalent of Y2K. I say in the dedication of the book, I dedicate it to our seven grandchildren, and I say, you know, ultimately, I hope I'm wrong. But I don't think I am.
I know. I don't think you are either. And it's just a matter of not if, but when something like this is going to happen. And how do we find out about it, Ted? Does the whole system go down at one time? Will it just be a segment? Will it be, you know, a third of the country? What happens?
Look, there is incredible fine-tuning that can be done, you know, with these cyber attacks. And ironically, we and the Israelis launched the first major cyber attack against the Iranian nuclear facility at Natanz, and the what are those things called, the spinning things that spin the nuclear fuel, the centrifuges.
The centrifuges. Yeah.
We by inserting I'm having a
they,
senior
they
moment
the,
here,
the,
not
the,
helped
the
by
the rods and the centrifuges.
2:30 in the morning here.
You're used to being up late, you know.
Well,
that.
I used to do that. I haven't done it for a while. But by inserting the Stuxnet virus, not only did we succeed in setting those centrifuges spinning at the wrong speed, we also managed somehow to insert into the control room, into the television monitors that were monitoring the speed of these centrifuges and allowing the people at the control center to view what was going on. In something taken right out of Ocean's 11, we and the Israelis were able to insert a video of the centrifuges spinning at exactly the right speed, even though we had already knocked them off speed. And we succeeded in knocking the Iranian nuclear program back by about 18 months to 2 years. So the degree of sophistication, and this is already a number of years ago, the degree of sophistication and what can be done is extraordinary.
Did you expect the Iranian hostage situation to go as long as it did?
No, but I'll tell you a funny story. America Held Hostage was started, a section of the newsroom at ABC in Washington was set aside for the program. And we had our own telephones assigned to that section. And the extension number of our phone was 444. So for the entire time that we were doing it, we didn't realize, but the length of the time that the hostages were held, 444 days, was in front of us from the very beginning.
That is remarkable. And when it ended, A lot of people turned to your program because you had been on it so well. And it just catapulted Nightline that lasted so long, and my God, how strong it is. I was on Nightline a couple years ago. I was interviewed there based on the show. And again, the congratulations to you for a program like 60 Minutes that just kept going and going and going.
Yeah, hard to believe. Coming up on 36 years now.
Wow. You were 40 years old when you started that.
Yes. And if you can do the math, you know where I am right now.
Let's go out to Atlanta, Georgia. Anthony, you're on with Ted Koppel on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Hey, Ted, you're unforgettable in my book.
Perfect.
And I just want, my question is, given the message on the Georgia Guidestones of population control, don't you think the powers that be, if they wanted to do something about this by now, they would have?
That's a little conspiratorial here for you, Ted.
Yeah,
but
it's a hard question to answer. I think, look, the best answer I got when I raised that question with Tom Ridge, who was the first Secretary of Homeland Security. Tom Ridge said, you know, we are great as a nation in terms of reacting to crises. We are not good at preemptive action. You know, trying to get the American public or our representatives in Congress right now to set aside the kind of money that ought to be set aside, let's say, for freeze-dried food, for the kind of storage of freeze-dried food that the federal government ought to begin undertaking so that in the event of an attack like this or any other disaster, any other long-lasting crisis, there would be enough food there. Let me just give you a small example. At the moment, the state of New York has 25 million meals ready to eat. 25 million MREs. Sounds like a lot. Think just about New York City. If the people of New York City were out of food and had to rely on that supply, it would be essentially a three-day supply. I asked the man who heads up Homeland Security, or headed it up at the time that I talked to him for New York State, what do you do after those 25 million meals run out? In other words, 3 days into a crisis. And he said, then we're in trouble.
Yeah, big time. I've got a client, Ted, my Patriot Supply. They sell storable food. FEMA sent them a notice that said, we'd like to buy your entire stock. They turned them down because they have got customers. But everybody was wondering, what the heck are they preparing for? What do they know that we might not know? Are they just being smart, or do you think they do know that something is afoot here?
No. I mean, one of the things that I learned, and it's amazing, when you start reporting on a story, you learn things about areas of the country that you never knew about. An awful lot of these companies that produce the freeze-dried food and the MREs are out in Utah.
Utah, that's right.
And in fact, many of them are run by Mormon. The Mormons are terrific when it comes to disaster preparation. They've had almost a 200-year history of living through one disaster after another, and it has become sort of ingrained in the Mormon culture. And one of the things that the church has recommended to its membership is that they have a 3 to 6 month supply of food in their homes. So they are terrific at this. One of the things I learned when
for a second, Ted. We've got to hit the break, and then we're going to come right back with more and final calls. Okay, we're going to come back in just a moment with Ted Koppel. We're going to take your final phone calls here as we talk about his work, an incredible book called Lights Out, a cyber attack on our power grid systems. And I'm telling you, it would be a disaster of biblical proportions indeed. So we'll be back in a moment with Ted and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Ted Koppel with us. Our final segment, Lights Out, the name of his book. And Ted, I assume it's available all over the place, the book?
It is all over the place.
Excellent, indeed. What's your next project? What are you going to do next?
Listen, I'm still trying to finish off this project. As I'm sure you know, researching and writing the book is the easy part. It's selling the book that takes time.
Oh, my gosh, it sure does. And what has been the reception? Now, you've just mentioned that it was a great seller on the New York Times list. Are you getting the kind of media exposure that you should get with this?
Perfect. No, I mean, I've been doing nothing but media now for the past, well, it's over a month now. So yes, I'm getting a lot of exposure on it. In fact, I rather suspect that people are getting tired of hearing the same message over and over again.
How's it feel being on the other side of the desk?
Well, it feels fine. As long as I'm dealing with a pro like you, it's easy.
I learned from you.
And you know, I think people would prefer if we stopped scratching one another's back.
Well, I'm going to tell you this, and this is not scratching your back. Do you know what it's like for someone who's been in broadcasting all my life, since I was 19 years old, watching you on television countless number of times as I was growing up in broadcasting, and now I'm interviewing you on my national show? I mean, that has got to be one of the greatest events of one's career. I mean, and I'm not trying to blow smoke at you. It's the truth.
Well, either way, it's a very generous thing of you to say, and I appreciate it, George.
All right, let's go to the phones. First-time caller, Todd, in New Jersey. Todd, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for that. I like getting my news from you. Two best ones on the air. Wow.
There you go.
Bye. Hey, Ted, this is like kind of what was my profession. I'm a power lineman and a chemical weapons technician in the service. And I always think about this stuff because what takes place on these facilities should stay on these facilities. A lot of these systems, they ain't hooked up to the Internet. And why would it cost so much money to run a system like that? Because, look at the decade, how bad it's been. We don't need to be terrorized. Are you guys still with me?
Yep, we're listening.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I'll just keep it brief because a lot of stuff I did was classified. I don't talk about it much, but it does worry me, you know?
Well, if somebody like you is concerned, then we have some deeper problems than we might even know about. My gosh. Let's go to Frank, Hollywood, Maryland. Frank, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you.
You too, Frank.
I've been waiting 30 years to talk to you. When you were down here in St. Inigo's, I saw you in the store one day, and I wanted to approach you and say hello, but I just don't impose on people. I just won't do it.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've had a house down there in St. Inigo's, Maryland, for I guess about 30 years now, and it's one of the great secret treasures in the United States.
Beautiful down there by St. Mary's College, isn't it?
Sorry, I didn't hear the question.
It's beautiful down there by St. Mary's College.
Absolutely. It's spectacular, and it's a good school, St. Mary's College.
Go ahead with your question, Frank. Go ahead.
My question is, I just wanted to tell Mr. Koppel that of all the Nightline episodes, one stands out with me. The night you had the late Dodger general manager, Al Campanis, on the show.
Oh, absolutely.
He gave
I remember it well.
Opportunity to change his story about black managers and their ability to manage. What I want to ask you is, was he drinking that night?
No, I don't think so. For those among your audience, George, who are too young to remember, it was actually a program about Jackie Robinson.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And the reason we had Al Campanis on is that Al Campanis and Jackie Robinson had actually been roommates when they were both players. And I think part of what happened is Al Campanis, he called me some years later. He ended up saying some unfortunate things on that program about blacks not having the capability to be managers, and it ended up costing him his job with the Dodgers. And he called me some years later when I was out in L.A., and he and I had a cup of coffee together. I think it was a generational thing. He was, you know, he was at that point, I think, already in his 70s. And he said the kinds of things on the air that I guess people of his generation used to say all the time when they were having a beer or a cup of coffee with a friend. And I'm afraid it was just the wrong time, the
wrong
place.
Yep.
I tried several times to give him the opportunity to undo what he had said, and he did not get it at the time.
When when you were covering stories for Nightline that were non-breaking, so it wasn't the Iranian hostage or 9/11 or the Iraq war, but just general stories, how did you and your producers, Ted, pick the selected topics for that program?
You know, it's, we would get on the phone every morning at about 9:30, and I would be on with my executive producer and a couple of the senior producers. And we would talk about possible stories for that day, and then we had a staff meeting at 10:30 or 11 in the morning where the entire staff would be present. And it really was, I mean, it was whoever came up with the best idea, we would go with it that day. And it was an extraordinary team that was capable of putting together a half-hour program with just a few hours' notice.
Did you have dedicated external reporters, or did you have to tap into the ABC network news
Both.
Folks?
We had our Nightline correspondents, and then when needed. I mean, in the early days of Nightline, before Nightline really became a success, the hotshot reporters at ABC didn't want to hang around until 11:30 at night. We did the program live, as you do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that easy, as you probably know. You better than most know it's not easy. Here on the East Coast now, it's coming up on 2:45 in the morning.
That's right.
It's not that easy to get people to stay up that late. So we had to have our own dedicated correspondents.
Before we go to final calls, Ted, of everyone you've interviewed in your career, who's that one person that stands out to be probably that interview you'll never forget?
I'll tell you, it's one you would never think of, but there was a young woman who was the product of a relationship between an African-American U.S. soldier and a Vietnamese bar girl. And the soldier went back home, and years later he realized that he had a daughter in Vietnam, and he must have had an extraordinarily understanding wife, because she permitted him to go back, find this young woman, who by then was about 20 or 21 years old, and bring her to the United States.
Wow.
Which he did. And I interviewed her, and by the time I interviewed her, she already spoke very good English. And I said, tell me, what's the most extraordinary thing about the United States? And she said, the sky. And I said, you know, that's a very strange answer. I said, I spent the better part of 3 years in Vietnam, and the sky in Vietnam looks pretty much like the sky in the United States. Oh, no, she said, in Vietnam, I was much too ashamed to look up.
Wow. Boy, that gets right to you. It really does. Norm's in St. Louis. There you go, Norm. You're on with Ted Koppel. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Great, thank you.
Good. I understand about the EMP and everything, and mm-hmm. I think maybe your average person out there might not be real familiar with the issues at hand, but I think the powers that be and more prevalent people know about it. And I just got a couple comments. They're scaffolding around the Capitol building. They were supposed to power wash it. It's been up for like 3 years. I watch NBC Nightly News. I never see anybody up on it power washing. Do you kind of think that possibly there's a correlation to that's maybe an EMP proof scaffolding like around it? And my second comment would be to do with the powers that be. I think it's up in West Virginia. You got that Mount Weather, which is an underground bunker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure if something hits the fan, that's where the Warren Buffetts and Hillary Clintons of the world will be hiding out. But people at the bottom of the heap like myself, we won't have a place
well,
to go.
I got to tell you, I don't think Warren Buffett would be down in a bunker because...
I think he'll stay out in Omaha, Nebraska. He'll probably be just fine.
I do too. There. Hillary might be down there.
Yeah,
but,
no, I got to tell you, I haven't seen anybody on that scaffolding either, but yours is an interesting, if unique theory.
A Faraday cage blocking any kind of signal. Who knows?
That could do it.
What that could be. I don't fault government, Ted. If they do have these underground bunkers, and we believe they do, as a place to go to keep government going and functioning. I think that's important. What a lot of people, however, suspect is that the elitists in the country will die for that. And then, of course, the average folks, the middle class, they're gone. Who knows?
Well, you know, we were starting to talk about, and it'll be nice for your sponsor, but we were starting to talk about these emergency supplies and products. One of the problems is that people forget it takes time to grow food.
Yes, it sure
does. It takes time to process food. It takes time to freeze dry the food and then to warehouse it. If the government were attempting to get a really large supply, it would probably take years for that to be accomplished. They've got to begin somewhere.
Yeah, they do. There's no question about that. But like you said, even if they have 25 million packages available, how long will that last? Several days?
It's not going to last long. That's why, you know, I mean, you were talking about Department of Homeland Security trying to acquire
the FEMA. FEMA one.
Oh, FEMA. Well, FEMA works for DHS. Yeah.
Let's go to Roger in Shingletown, California now. Raj, thanks for holding so long. Go ahead.
Oh, wow. I can't believe this. Sir, it's just an honor. It's just totally an honor. I know you since I was in college, and, you know, this whole thing reminds me of maybe Dr. Strangelove really is a computer geek or something. But the thing of it is I'd like to find out if there's there's some sort of a hybrid, something that like an oscillation of electric current, which is basically what an EMP is, if that could be created by a computer.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to let you
mean
down
like
after your nice introduction. I don't know.
You mean like a virus that would eat its way through?
No, like a virus that would cause an internal EMP within the computer itself.
Hmm. That's a good question.
I have no
idea.
That
would be unstoppable. And you know, the whole thing of this issue is, you know, that it would be like a hybrid between the two. And with the research I've done on both subjects, the EMP as well as the computer-generated attack, there's nothing mentioned in terms of hybridization of the two.
And I would guess, Ted, that they've got to have some kind of huge firewall systems up all over the place.
Yeah, the problem with firewalls is as simple as this. A worker at one of the power companies, and they do have firewalls, everything is air-gapped. Somebody takes home a thumb drive, plugs the thumb drive into his computer at home, brings it back to work the next day. It's infected. The system is infected. A firewall is no defense against a stupid employee.
No, that is absolutely true. Are the employees, those on the inside, are they concerned about the possibility of a cyber attack?
Oh, yes. I mean, and people within the electric power industry, they have to be. They are constantly under attack. Look, there are cybersecurity companies out there that put out what they call honeypots. In other words, they will put out something that is meant to attract hackers. It isn't really connected to a system, but it does attract hackers. And what they've been finding very recently is the Chinese are attacking, the Russians are attacking, but they're attacking for the purpose of mapping the system, of gathering intelligence. ISIS, on the other hand, is attacking with the goal of destroying the system.
Yes.
And they've actually had attacks that have come from ISIS.
And they obviously don't care if they destroy themselves in the process.
Well, you know, I mean, what is it that we can do to them that we aren't already doing? In other words, they are totally immune to a cyber counterattack. Where's their infrastructure? There is no infrastructure.
They have none.
They have none, exactly.
Let's go to Marty, truck driving in Washington State. Marty, go ahead.
Well, good morning, and it's an honor to speak with both of you.
Great.
Being in the trucking industry, of course, naturally, I think a lot about the transportation of goods and services. Trucking is basically the glue that holds the economy together. And with the EMP, I'm pretty sure that it would pretty much crash not only the computers and the electricity and everything, but all of our vehicles, like the one I'm driving now, All the systems are computerized. Would anything with regard to a cyber attack, would that have the same effect as an EMP? Would it necessarily crash?
Well, we just had a report a few months ago about hackers getting into Jeeps, I believe, that were driving around on the freeway. They hacked into them and shut them down.
Yeah, but George, I think you need to draw a distinction here. An EMP attack would have the impact of knocking out all the electronics.
Right, it would fry it.
It would fry it immediately. The cyber attack would have to be targeted. So it's not going to have the sort of same universal impact.
Do you believe that a cyber attack would be an act of war, Ted?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of cyber attack that you and I have been talking about for the last couple of hours, a cyber attack that knocks out all or part of an electric power grid would be the equivalent of an act of war. It would have the impact of adversely affecting and costing the lives of thousands of Americans.
We better be right when we pick the spot of where it came from.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the great problem. You can't launch a counterattack if you don't know for sure who did it. Just imagine the president sitting in the Situation Room and his best intelligence advisors are saying, well, we think it came from the Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly.
But we can't be sure.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, you knew it was the Japanese.
That's correct.
When Hitler went into Poland, you knew it was the Nazis. But in this particular case, you just don't know what's going to happen.
That's exactly right.
We've only got about a minute left. I just want to thank you again for being on the program. Continued success to you. And truly, thank you for all your years of dedication to America in your broadcasting.
Well, you and your audience have been very kind to me. Thank you very much.
Ted Koppel, the name of the book, Lights Out. His website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, are we on the brink, after everything you've heard, of World War III? Joel Skousen joins me. We're going to be talking about that right here on Coast to Coast AM. And some of you who did not have an opportunity to get through, you can call back later with Joel, because we will take phone calls in the final hour. As far as our logistics, of course, don't forget to continue to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, where every day we put out new information about this program. I'll be back in a moment as we talk about the future on Coast to Coast AM.